All right, well, thanks everyone. Now I want to talk a little bit more about the Open Philanthropy Project. I just want to give a very brief high-level overview of what we're trying to do, and then we'll just let Chloe dive in about her work on criminal justice reform. So Open Philanthropy, we mentioned it a little bit in the first session, but it's our partnership with the Foundation Good Ventures. And Good Ventures is a foundation that was started by Dustin Moskovitz and Carrie Tuna. Like Natalie said, Dustin is the co-founder of Facebook and now Asana. And so we've been working with them over the last few years to essentially answer the same question that that Holden and I had when we started GiveWell, which is, where should I give to accomplish the most good? But where GiveWell tries to answer that question for the retail donor, you know, someone giving maybe a few hundred dollars up to $1 million, Open Philanthropy is trying to answer the question for the extremely large philanthropist, you know, philanthropists that could give hundreds of millions of dollars a year. We're partnering now on this project with Good Ventures. We hope to partner with other really large philanthropists in the future. Last year, we started a partnership with Mike Krieger and Caitlin Trigger. Mike is one of the co-founders of Instagram. And so we're hopeful that, you know, Open Philanthropy will be a way that tech philanthropists and other large philanthropists give in the future. We're basically looking in four broad cause areas. The major areas of focus for us are U.S. policy, where I think philanthropy has had a lot of success historically in changing policy and having an effect. And the idea here is that government spends so much that charity can potentially leverage a great deal of money. What we call global catastrophic risks, which are areas where there's a very low probability of some catastrophic event happening that could really derail the trajectory of humanity. You know, over the last couple hundred years, we've really increased wealth and reduced poverty by a significant amount, and anything that could significantly derail that progress is potentially very, very concerning. I think one of the types of risk that gets a lot of attention is the risk from asteroids. This is something we have looked into. There is a page on our website about it. I think it's an area where NASA has done a pretty good job of tracking at least the most dangerous ones. But there are still risks that we're focusing on. Two of the top priorities are risk from artificial intelligence and what we call biosecurity and pandemic preparedness. So either emerging natural pandemics or synthetic engineered pandemics, either accidentally released from a lab or the subject of a state or bioterrorism. These are areas that don't seem to get as much attention philanthropically as they might deserve. And then a third area of focus is scientific research, basic science. Again, this is an area where philanthropy has had some of its biggest successes historically. The sort of biggest questions we're trying to answer right now with each cause are, you know, how big an impact could you have if you succeed in this cause? How neglected is the cause? With the idea that the fewer people who are involved, the more likely we are to be able to make a difference with the money that we're recommending. And then finally, how tractable is it? How likely is it that we're able to make a difference if we get involved? Just in terms of our progress this year, you know, a lot of our focus has been on hiring people who know much more about the fields that we're focused on than we do. Chloe is one example of this. She knows criminal justice reform well. She's an expert. We're not. And so now she's leading our grant making in that area. We also hired Lewis Ballard, who's a program officer focused on farm animal welfare, which is trying to reduce the suffering that animals have largely in factory farms. And then we're now working with trial hires that we hope will become full-time hires in scientific research and then in artificial intelligence. Finally, I should just flag that, I sort of spend most of my time on the topic of GiveWell that we talked about, and then on sort of general organization capacity building and hiring. And so, you know, I'm probably not going to be a good person to answer general questions about open philanthropy, though we'll see. If you're interested in asking them, feel free. But I think our hope with this session, and this is sort of new for us in one of these events, is to focus primarily on criminal justice reform, which is our, you know, really our most developed program area to date. So I guess I'll just turn it over to Chloe and let her tell you about what she's doing.
Okay. Hi. It's nice to be here. So I just started Open Philanthropy full time in August, and I have hit the ground sprinting, I think, because I am so excited about this cause and the opportunities here. A little about my background. I'm a lawyer, graduated in 2007 and did a number of law jobs, all in criminal justice. Then ended up at the ACLU doing policy work, working with our ACLU affiliates around the country on mass incarceration, the issue generally, trying to pass legislation and generally advise our affiliates on the issue so that they could engage, particularly in some of the smaller states where the ACLU is like the only game in town. And then through that work, built up a huge network of contacts, relationships, spent tons of time thinking about the issue, building up an analysis of different types of interventions, both in matters of policy, but also like ways to deal with the topic. And it was with that background that I came to Open Phil, and I'm really excited to bring that expertise to bear. So just a tiny bit about the problem. I could say so much more about this, but like, you know, well, what we're starting with is that a big development in American policy over the past few years is an increasing attention to the problem of over-incarceration and over-criminalization. The graph, like from the 70s, you know, goes like this through the century, and goes like this from 1970 till 2010, and then levels off a little bit. And for all of these years, lots of people were making noise around this increasing problem, but no one was paying any attention. And then due to a variety of factors, it began to gain traction and really click, and that's in part what drew Open Philanthropy to this topic. In addition, there's a bipartisan consensus around this being an issue of concern, and so it's not like in this normal polarized space that many American policy issues are in. So it's been shooting up. You know, not only the U.S. prison population is the highest in the world, the U.S. incarceration rate is the highest in the world. 35 U.S. states have a higher incarceration rate than any other country over 500,000 people. And Maine still the lowest, like teeny tiny Maine with like, for our standards, you know, 5 people basically incarcerated, still has a higher incarceration rate than any country in Europe. And there's a neat graph that like compares every U.S. state to all the other countries in the world over 500,000. So it's pretty striking, and it's not just like Louisiana and Texas that have the problem. So I mentioned there's this sort of growing consensus that this is not good, and also that the harms are outweighing the benefits, and the benefits are even contested. We have our researcher David Rudman is looking now into the question of whether incarceration is criminogenic, and it seems like it is. It's complicated to sift through all the research on it, but there's a notion that it's not like, you know, it's a bad policy idea, but it is safe. It actually looks like, in fact, it's not good in any dimension, and we need to look for other solutions. And with all of that going on, the amount of resources going into this field are incredibly small. I want to get at some point numbers comparing like investments in American criminal justice reform compared to education, health, and other top issue areas, but like, I don't know what those other areas are. I think it's probably like a lot of money in criminal justice. It's in the tens of millions of dollar range, which is incredibly small given the millions of people incarcerated and all of the like collateral effects that it has. So to find good opportunities, I spent a lot of time talking to colleagues in the field. I talked to lawyers, advocates, organizers, journalists, academics. I connect to other funders in this space and see what they're thinking about. And as a criminal justice policy expert myself, I spent a lot of time thinking about what solutions are likely to be the best. There's no single solution. There's no like Supreme Court case or federal bill or like, you know, magical one thing that's going to solve this, in part because this system is really many systems, and it's like the garbage can for many other failed social policies, so it's a little complicated. So I'm going to share some areas of focus that I'm looking at now and say a little bit more after I run through them, I'll share some more detail on them. So my priority grant area is on advocacy to change state and local laws and policies. That's going to end up getting the most resources in any grant scenario. A second key priority area is prosecutors, who are getting a lot more attention in the wake of Ferguson and here in New York. They're extremely powerful actors within the system, basically unaccountable electorally or otherwise, and they have huge amounts of discretion over what they do in their offices, and then they also turn up in legislatures and are very impactful with their testimony there. So that's a key focal point. Also looking at alternatives to incarceration, that have the potential to be like systematic solutions, new ways that we want to go, new premises to set our system on. So looking at restorative justice and this program called LEAD that I'll tell you a little bit about later. And then I'm also looking at grants aiming to increase and diversify the constituencies that are pushing for solutions on this. So it's not just a teeny tiny number of people who know a lot, but faith and women and evangelical, Latinos and different sort of constituency bases whose interest was turned in this could really amp up the advocacy capacity in the space, because the political opportunity is right now, but the field is not developed enough to really functionally take advantage of that. And so we're trying to come up to speed pretty quickly. In all the areas, I'd say I'm aiming for something clear and tangible in terms of benefits now with the investment, and then also having attention towards the structural implications of moving in that direction. So it's not like good now, but sets us up in a very bad position in 5 years. So on the first area, which is advocacy to change laws and policies, our biggest investment to start will be the Alliance for Safety and Justice, which is a new multi-state policy reform group led by the same team that did Prop 47 in California, which none of you may have heard of here in New York, but it was a big deal in California. It's resulted in a 16,000 person reduction in the prison population in 1 year. Basically took six felonies, drug possession, some low-level drug and theft crimes, and reduced them from felonies to misdemeanors. So a felony can send you to prison for many, many years. A misdemeanor, you can only go to jail, and I actually don't know what the cap is in California. It might just be a year cap. So it's pretty significant, felony down to misdemeanor. And so that team is a politically sophisticated team and really is actually starting from a strong safety analysis. Like, what do communities need in order to be safe and healthy? They have a huge constituency of victims of crime that they have polled and worked with to figure out, like, where should resources be going, and how do we like actually foster real safety rather than spending tons of money churning people through prison? And grounded in that, they brought Prop 47, and grounded in that also, they'll do reform in multiple different types of states. So a concern that I have about the grant is just the size of the undertaking. Is they're going to work and bring their model to multiple states at the same time, working on multiple dimensions. The team is the best that there is, in my view, in terms of this type of state policy reform, but it will still be a lift. And also different states have different conditions. Of course, other states are not like California, so to speak. On the other hand, California has dozens of law enforcement constituency groups who are extremely vocal and strong in their opposition to change. So it's not like it's easy sailing in like blue California on criminal justice. In fact, it can even be harder in places that are controlled by the Democratic Party to move because of the sensitivity within the party to appearing to be, not taking a strong stance on criminal justice issues. Fun political dynamics that have been cycling through for several decades. So on prosecutors, I'm looking at investments that increase accountability, including investigating some of this wild and west world of prosecutorial elections that people understand very little about. Most people don't even know their prosecutors are elected, let alone who they are and on what basis they should be making that decision. Most prosecutors are uncontested, are elected in uncontested races. And often what happens, even if it's an open seat, the person will like retire a little early and then basically get their successor in there. It's pretty undemocratic in that way. And there's also, a lot of misconduct that goes totally ignored. And so there's a couple of grants looking at trying to understand that space better and also to bring to light more of that misconduct, because once exposed, for example, there was a mini version of the Accountability Project was done in by another funder called David Menschel, who funded some research into a place called Caddo, Louisiana, where the prosecutor was just like out of control, you know, in terms of withholding evidence and, you know, just doing a lot of like real misconduct. And once that was exposed, he didn't stand for re-election. And then they just had an election where I think it was a state judge ran for prosecutor and won. So just exposing that, those realities can be beneficial to improving the conduct of the office. And then looking at alternatives, another area I'll just go into a little detail on. I'm looking at an organization called Common Justice in Brooklyn, which provides a restorative justice alternative for victims and perpetrators in cases of serious violence. So this is interesting because very few, if any, interventions in the United States really focus on violence, particularly serious violence. It's considered kind of a third rail. But it turns out restorative justice conferencing, which is one-on-one conferencing in a certain, you know, controlled setting where people have been prepared, is extremely, has been shown in randomized controlled trials in numerous places to be quite successful and in fact better at than the current system at restoring, you know, making victims feel whole afterwards and reducing recidivism. So it looks promising, hasn't been studied with this population here in, you know, New York, and that's part of the program is both doing the work, but also there's an ongoing research study. And in addition, why I'm excited about this grant is that the director of the program has been thinking about how to talk about violence and what to do about this difficult issue longer and in a more sophisticated way than anyone else. And we're at this point with criminal justice reform where people are realizing that you don't actually really end mass incarceration just looking at low-level drug offenses. So what are we supposed to do? And Danielle's thought really long and hard about that and has a sophisticated way of really moving through that that takes account of the need for accountability and understanding people's context and coming up with a solution that is grounded in people's need for safety and, you know, some kind of correct compensation for the harm that was done. And then the last thing I'll point out is this program called Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion coming out of Seattle. The basic model is that basically all these agencies in Seattle got together and came up with an MOU. So instead of, you know, people interacting with, so an individual person will end up interacting with lots of different players in a municipality without them talking to each other, which results in a lot of churn through the system. So here the police, the defenders, the prosecutors, the treatment providers, the mayor's office, rather, the ACLU, and there may be another, but at least those players got together and figured out how they were going to work together and communicate. And when encountering someone engaged in certain low-level activity on the street, such as prostitution or low-level drug sale, instead of making an arrest and doing the thing and then determining you need services and actually it's a mental health issue and you like spend all this money and go around and end up with like services, they just bring the person directly to services and skip all the other pieces. A recent study by the Arnold Foundation show that it is more effective at reducing recidivism than the current model and just costs a ton less and is more humane and better for the person who doesn't spend time in jail while, you know, completing this circuit. So lots of municipalities are interested in this, and the proposal is to have kind of a national coordinating center to assist these cities in doing it. Because, you know, in some places you're really trying to build a political consensus for reform and like fighting tough fights. In other places you have officials who are like, we would love to not be doing this the way that we're doing it, but how do we do it in another way? And so this is an example of investing in something that really supports governments in work doing things differently in a way that's been assessed and researched and have some basis for supporting. So that's just like a overview. 13 minutes overview of the basic where I'm starting with, and I have a lot more interesting opportunities identified, and you know 2016 is going to be a pretty interesting year. I don't think we've crested yet on the amount of intensity of interest in the issue, but of course with the presidential race people have a hard time focusing on anything, so we'll see what happens. Questions? Yeah.
So getting to something you mentioned near the end, there's definitely a contrast between working through the political system and dealing with elected officials, the electoral process, and advocacy
That's an interesting question. I think that I have to think about that a bit before I'm going to give a really good answer. Do I have anything top of mind? Well, first of all, I don't have the experience with every jurisdiction in the U.S. to give a real answer to that question, a real comparative one. My sense would be that the places that are where it's really an administrative question, where they're like, yeah, please just work with us, are ones where the sort of volume is pretty low. It's not like they tend to be smaller jurisdictions or places where it's just, you know, and where someone, if you're good with them, they can just kind of do what they want, you know. The sheriff could like change all these policies. Unlike, for example, a place like New York, which is very, you know, intensely packed with various different actors and different interests. And it's unlikely that you would just, where it's just gonna be a kind of bureaucratic solution. But those latter places where politically informed advocacy are more important also tend to be the ones where the people are and thus the numbers are. So I don't think that would be true in every case. You would certainly wanna be like looking for opportunities where you could take a less kind of fraught route to solution. But when I'm thinking back to my sort of experiences, particularly working with the ACLU and in multiple jurisdictions, I think you could broadly say there's a sort of inverse relationship between like size of the problem and like ability to solve it with that type of intervention.
That was all really, really very interesting. I was wondering if you have any kind of, if you've done any work to kind of get a broader view of the picture and say, like, conceivably, like, in 5 years, we can maybe, like, with this amount of effort, we can free this many people from prison or reduce sentences this much. Like, do you look at things at the broader scope level, or are you mostly working with the time frame?
Definitely want to look at things broadly, and that was something that I think, my interest in thinking that way was, I think, part of why Open Philanthropy decided that I'd be a good person to work on this. My general thought is that it's too soon to come up with the grand strategy because so many of the critical pieces of infrastructure aren't yet in place, and that's part of what I want to be doing. So the Alliance for Safety and Justice that I mentioned is going to like fill a significant gap in well-informed, you know, solutions grounded, victims' needs grounded, politically sophisticated criminal justice reform. And once they start to get going and we see how well does their strategy, the coming out of California, work in other places, if I see that happen in 2-3 states and it's looking really good, I can start to like imagine how that's gonna play out in another 30 states. But I can't tell you that now because I've just seen that model in one state. And I think that's true across a number of dimensions. For example, we've never had like sophisticated communications in this field on any level. No organization has really had them. So, you know, what will happen when that capacity is brought online and people hear about this topic from a different perspective? Like, will minds change very quickly, or will there be like very significant sticking points we have to build other things to address? Hard to say. So, it's the one thing that we can look at for a model here, I think, but that's different in some key ways, is the speed at which that we've seen decarceration of young people under 18, which has seen about a 50% reduction in rate over about a 10-year period. So that shows us that type of thing is possible. Particularly interesting given that in the 90s, everyone was talking about super predator kids and they're them up and they're going to get you. And now people are like, yeah, incarcerating kids is probably really not a good idea, and we're very reluctant to do it. It's a total shift in mindset that you wouldn't even have noticed unless you're like focusing on it all the time. And then there's a question, well, how did that happen? And the first report on that is going to come out, I think, in the next very short few months. But it can be difficult even for, you know, the people who've done the work after the fact to figure out like what was the combination of different types of interventions that brought about that shift in thinking, and then what would it take to do that in terms of money, number of people involved, geographic spread to accomplish that on the adult side. So I would love, I'm aiming to get to the point where I can answer that question.
That brings my specific issue, and
think there might be one other state. I'm sorry.
Why is that? Can that be changed easily? And what's it?
Yeah, that's so I'm less familiar with the details of it, but there is a campaign called Raise the Age in New York, which is specifically focused on that. And I think they got to they got somewhere with the governor, but it needs to be funded. So there's like been this huge effort of many, many groups, but it's kind of stuck. That's my sense of where it's at right now.
What needs to be funded?
So part of raising the age, if you raise it from 16 to 18, is you bring some many thousands of people under the jurisdiction of the juvenile courts and detention centers, which means you need to like have more capacity
so
there.
If there's some more expensive
Yeah. Or even if they weren't, you'd need more. You'd need to like do some stuff there. But in fact, they are much more expensive because we treat kids with more care. So that's a whole process, but yes. And then, so on the other hand, so New York is stuck at 16, whereas Connecticut is proposing raising the age of jurisdiction to 21. So you bring a whole like three more years of people into a different set of mindset of how we think about people's, where they are at developmentally. And I was just speaking to someone in this room back there from Princeton earlier about the impact of brain science and the juvenile side has been so huge because people realize like, oh, dealing with an 18-year-old, you're not dealing with a fully functional, present, like person able to think 10 steps ahead and understand the consequences of their actions in the same way that you would when dealing with a 30-year-old person, and people have found that in policy to be something relevant to consider. It's where you set that age is really important. And it's that kind of decision that I think is totally invisible to most people as being very relevant. I think most people would assume that incarceration is driven by crime. In fact, it bears very little relationship to crime. It's mostly driven by policy decisions like that. Crime has been dropping precipitously. It's now at the lowest level in decades. But incarceration until very recently has just been going up. And that's a function of many things, including, for example, prosecutors, who I mentioned before, using their discretion in ways that end up with many more people getting felony convictions than before for the same behavior. That's just one example of policy driving incarceration rather than crime.
What, if any, measures and metrics of effectiveness in terms of preference for dollars spent are you doing or looking to do as far as this area goes?
Well, so first of all, it's definitely not my forte to think in those ways, but luckily I have colleagues at Open Philanthropy who do think like that all day long, so that's good. One of the first, another grant that I didn't name specifically that we're working towards is, but it's not yet final, is a campaign to close Rikers, the jail in New York City, and then rely on various like much smaller jails in the boroughs. Part of it because, Rikers is a very terrible place, but in terms of my mission of decarceration, there's, they built it and then they came kind of thing. There's like 10,000 person daily census on Rikers, and there's consensus among experts that could certainly that number drop to 5,000, if not lower, because, for example, many people are there simply because they can't pay money bail, and if you didn't have that jail, you just wouldn't have the option of having a ridiculous policy of incarcerating people because they don't have $200 to get out of jail. Happily, an interesting aspect of the Rikers work also is we're pretty clear, we're starting with 10, we think we can get to 5, that's a 5,000 person reduction with a, I think Alexander called it a 20% chance of success over however many years with this input, and like he came up with a dollar, and I can't actually remember what the dollar per individual no longer in jail per year was, and found that to be favorable compared to like give directly. So yes, you can. And then of course some things are harder, like what's the value of evangelical Christians deciding this is a thing that they care about. I can't like put a number on that, but we can imagine it being very impactful given spaces or the number of legislators who would be really care about their voice and not so much care about the ACLU's voice, for example. But once we have Rikers in place, we could maybe like compare to Rikers in a more qualitative way and still have some, still be thinking of it in terms of efficiency of dollar spent, because that's certainly a value. We don't want to be sort of, we don't want to spend like, it's obviously we don't want to spend $1 million getting like 100 people out of prison in Virginia unless you know that you've done it with such a leading edge policy reform that if 20 other states did it, it would actually add up to a lot. So as a general value, like I can do that calculation in my head having done the policy work, the specific like 250X or whatever is gonna be much easier in some places than others, and we'll have to kind of do our best. Because we don't only wanna do things where we know exactly how many people are gonna be impacted. Again, because the evangelical example you might get, that could be like really great and in fact critical to like remove policy obstacles, but it's not actually a specific numerical outcome.
So I mean, we're trying to undertake this type of analysis, and one of the ways we've been thinking about it recently is comparing the impact, the estimated impact of a program to our GiveWell's top charities as some baseline. And so there's a couple of recent blog posts that we wrote that touch on this that talk about how to think about, how we're thinking now about the size of grants that we should be recommending that good ventures make, both in open philanthropy and to GiveWell top charities. And so if you're interested in this topic and kind of this question in general, two recent blog posts go into it.
Well, in the Alliance for Safety and Justice case, you know, a key thing they're already starting with, because they're growing out of an existing organization, so have already started work, even though we haven't moved the grant to them yet. They're working with Michigan, where the key policy reform that's moving now is on parole. So it's, you know, it's not uniformly the case, so I'm thinking way upstream. Though in general, I tend to be biased towards upstream, because if you can get upstream, you stop people going down. Yes. We need to attend to the number of people who are already sentenced and in prison. A big factor that many people don't consider or aren't aware of is that like something in many states, about a third of prison admissions are people coming back on parole and probation violations, technical violations. So like you missed one meeting or you missed 30 meetings, I don't know, it could have been like a sea of violations, but it's not actually for a new crime. So those are people who say we're in on robbery, got paroled or, you know, released after a certain number of time, and then were on supervision and then came back in. So when you look and say, what is that person in for? It says robbery, but really what they're in for is technical violation and parole probation. This is getting really technical, but which it means is, I think that there's, that population is more gettable than would appear to be the case, just based on the, if you just looked at it and you're like, oh my gosh, how many people are in prison for what length of sentence? It's hard to calculate because in order to suss that out, you need very specific state data that they won't just like hand over to you. You need to have relationships to get it. I just know that that's a sort of dynamic that comes up. The sort of bigger scale leading edge reforms I think that we could be working towards would be things like mass retroactive changes. Actually, Prop 47 in California is retroactive for these felonies changing down to misdemeanors. And because in California you can no longer be held in prison on a felony, on a misdemeanor, you can only be held in jail. That led to significant releases of people just because on their new status they couldn't be in prison anymore, they had to be in jail. And then jail, you know, they're not going to stay there for as long a time. But in various states, you can't actually do retroactive reform. Like in Florida, it's in the Constitution, you can't do that. So it's a kind of a state-specific thing you have to figure out. Part of the goal of investing in Alliance for Safety and Justice is that they'll be the kind of state policy experts to spot those opportunities and look at whatever is going to get the deepest into the guts of things in particular states, whether they be front, middle, or back end.
All right, so let's just take two more questions because it's getting late and then we can wrap up.
I'm just wondering about the intertwining of some of the findings that you have, say reducing drug offenses from felony to misdemeanor out of California experience. To what degree does the felony misdemeanor division influence police behavior? And the one example I'm thinking of, and I'm forgetting the name of the recent University of Pennsylvania law graduate who lived in a Philadelphia, a tough Philadelphia neighborhood, and her conclusion, as I recall, was that the cops were being rewarded for felony joke bus, but we're under, we're insufficiently going after homicide bus. Because homicides are difficult, they're complex. You don't get, you know, for five easy dope bus, you get as much credit, right, in your policing behavior watch as you do for, say, one homicide. And that, her, to me, interesting conclusion was there has to be much more vigorous prosecution of homicides and much less vigorous prosecution of drug use. You're nodding. So
that is true.
and can that inform a public policy which could then be impelled by charitable donations from donors looking for effectiveness? That's the real question.
So that book is called On the Run. I can't remember the name of the author. A book that, if you're interested in that phenomenon and want to like nerd out on this stuff that I think is fabulous, is called The Collapse of American Criminal Justice, and talks about some of the perverse incentives of the way like these systems have emerged. It's by William Stuntz, S-T-U-N-T-Z, who was for many years criminal procedure professor at Harvard Law School, and was in fact my criminal procedure professor. Really brilliant guy. So yes, the incentive structure driven by, for example, federal funding streams has really benefited or driven police departments to adopt policing practices that overemphasize, in some analyses, drug busts, because not only is, you know, a certain number of drug busts going to be equivalent in some way to a murder, but in fact, because there's drug task force money specifically, right, you want to be churning those through. And so, like, the Brennan Center has done research and has made recommendations for changing how certain grants are made at the federal government level. And something that I'm not thinking about right now too much, but I have, like, a return to this topic in the future question, is whether there could be some interesting advocacy moves to shift how, like, Bureau of Justice Assistance, National Institute of Justice and DOJ, like Department of Justice, structure those funding streams and you know where money is being spent in terms of researching like the impacts of these policies or alternatives or whatever. I haven't like dug into that federal agency stuff, but I do think it could be interesting. Inspired in part by our Fed Up campaign at Open Philanthropy, which is targeting trying to get the Fed not to raise interest rates. It shows that, you know, you could think about like trying to move federal agencies to apply different kinds of you know, to change how they're shaping the space, and then would have huge effects because of how much money is involved. I think also just attending in general to the perverse incentives that are set up by the ways that people are rewarded both financially and professionally. For example, back to prosecutors, like you get promoted based on your wins, not on your diversions. And you could change that. For example, like, you know, you could have like a promotion set of matrix that looks at the degree to which you actually send people to non-incarceration solutions and reward that. So that's something that I think different people have started to think about, and I'm interested in, like, you know, groups that might push that further, for example, through, I guess, like, the budgeting process. There's all kinds of ways I can imagine that percolating through. Right now, what's in front of me are sort of opportunities where people, like, excellent leaders are ready to go with ideas that I can see being really useful. And then things like what you've just mentioned are ones that I have flags for, that should I encounter the group or a person that's going to be doing really interesting work there, I'd certainly be interested in them. But I'm not yet at the point of proactively formulating entities that are going to take on that type of thing, because I haven't run out of like the other seemingly impactful things. But I do think that that's the right way to think about it. Any last? Prince and Folk, you had your hands up before.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just something that I'm not going to be the right person to talk about. I mean, macroeconomic policy is one of the focus areas of open philanthropy, and Alexander Berger is the one who's led our work there. And the big picture idea is that the Fed's decisions could affect so many people and so much money that they could be incredibly impactful. There's a very strong constituency that seems to be arguing for higher interest rates, and it's not clear that the constituency that's saying like this, the economy will be severely affected, like the popular constituency whose lives will be affected, have as strong a voice. And so that is the idea behind the Fed Up campaign, but it's not something that I can really get
There's
into.
There's a good long write-up on the
That's always true. If you, yeah, that is always true.
So if you just look up Open Philanthropy Fed Up.
Or you can always just email Alexander directly. He's probably more... Anyhow, he loves it. I think it's funny that Holden and I left a finance company because we were really excited about charity and less excited about economics. And Alexander's working at a charity but stays up late on weekends reading about macroeconomic policy. And so that's a pretty funny outcome. Did anyone have a last question? And I know we've gone a little bit over. All right, so Tom, what are you?
So is there much among criminal justice reform?
When you say interventions, you mean
just different tactics for improving the state of criminal justice.
I'm going to take it to mean you're not talking about tactics for advocacy, but rather tactics for like what would we want a good well-functioning system to look like?
Yeah.
I think most people don't have a good answer to that question, and I think that people should get much more comfortable having an answer. My working hypothesis is like. Something like LEAD, like the program I mentioned out of Seattle for low-level stuff, something like, or in the realm of common justice, meaning restorative justice for more serious violent cases, though it has to be tested, but again, it's a hypothesis. And then for your sort of low-level thefts and assaults, I think so many of those are crimes of either actually related to drug use, which would be addressed by like better, not only, not just diverting people to services, but more investment in services, or economically related, and could be, they're not really, they're problems that will be reduced through better economic policies and addressing poverty. So that's where I'm working at. I wouldn't say that there's a consensus in the field. If you ask anyone, will they say that? But my experience has been actually, because I felt like it's really important to be able to say that when I've talked to my colleagues and said, well, what do you think about this? They're like, yeah, that seems like a great place to, like, I could agree with that as a working hypothesis about what we want things to look like. So I think it's, in part, it's been such a, it's an incredibly rapid turn from trying to get people to notice that this is even a problem and care about it to now everyone's asking what the good solutions are gonna be and what are we gonna spend billions of dollars to implement. That's like a couple of years. Where people are just so used to having to do this that they haven't yet shifted orientation to speak comfortably in a solutions frame, but I think it's important, and as I said, I have my working sense of what that looks like.
I mean, it seems like it'd be good to implement certain solutions more broadly, get data sets about them, get more shared information about them. That would be valuable in terms of implementing
that,
and that would also cycle back to the policy side, right?
Yes, and so that's part of in the portfolio, one of the things I'm going to be trying to do is both invest in those alternatives and invest in research on those alternatives to see, like, am I right? And also, if I'm right and people are right, then like, let's tell people about that and try more of those same types of things.
Great. Well, thanks. Thanks to everyone, to all of you for coming. We really appreciate your engaging with us and talking to us about our research. This is probably not as much fun as other charity events that you could go to, but we especially appreciate your participating in pizza and questions with GiveWell and Open Philanthropy. So thank you.